Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. What made Parkland different from the previous high school tragedies is the high school students themselves became the voice of tragedy. How do we recognize, understand, and respect teen voices, especially in the age of social media? Dr. Ann Clayson connects to 411 Teen via phone from New York. Dr. Clayson is the head of New York Society of Ethical Culture. Ethical NYC is a leading member of the American Ethical Union, a national organization that is committed to making the world more humane and more ethical by examining the choices we make and understanding that our lives are interrelated and independent. Here in the studio, joining me at the round table, I welcome Rabbi Jack Romberg. Rabbi Romberg has been serving Temple Israel here in Tallahassee and its congregates since he arrived in Tallahassee in 2001. He is very active in the local Tallahassee community. He launched Tallahassee Interfaith Clergy and writes columns and sat on the editorial board of the Tallahassee Democrat. Rabbi Romberg will be retiring in June 2019 and moving to Ponte Vedra Beach. Welcome to 411 Teen.
Thanks, Liz. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
This edition of 411 Teen explores moral reasoning, ethical behavior. What is the basis for ethical behavior? How do we define morals? Are there any situations where going against the grain, doing your own thing, is acceptable? How do you define right or wrong? Is it all relative? I open it to you all. You got all the answers.
Go ahead, Liz.
No, I just want to say and thank you, both of you, so much for taking the time to appear on 411 Teen.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I chuckled because you said we have all the answers. One thing that we emphasize in ethical culture, in religious humanism, is the power of questions. That one of the problems I think that we have in society today is that everybody thinks they have the answer. And I think what's important is to listen to what questions are being asked, and understand that, you know, we will have different responses. That's natural. And so, how do we listen and learn when we respond to those questions? And how do we empathize with the different values that are being expressed? And certainly, this whole controversy over gun violence has elicited, sadly, the worst in some people. We have an expression here in ethical culture where we say we choose to act in ways that elicit the best or the goodness in others and thereby in ourselves. And yet what we've experienced, I think, since this most recent horrendous school shooting is eliciting the worst in many people, which I think is very, very sad.
Yes, and so let me interject here, Anne. I think we're going to end up having a lot of agreement because one of the things that I teach our students, and I was telling Liz before that I am involved with teaching our teen group almost every week, and one of the basics of Judaism that I was taught from an Orthodox rabbi, not even a progressive rabbi, is that in Judaism, you must question everything. You cannot just take something at its face value. Yeah. You cannot just accept something just because it's written there. You must question it. So one of the basics that we try to teach all of our students, all of our teens, is to question everything. And questioning what's going on is certainly a key part of trying to establish what is the moral basis with which you can then improve the situation in your community and your society.
Well, I applaud you both on that. The point that you talk about questioning, particularly with teens, because, you know, that's not always acceptable. You know, teens are supposed to be quiet and listen and follow. And I know, and that's the reality, okay?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's certainly a time that you need to be quiet and to hear, but the context is always different. And
right.
you need to also have a time when you can question. You have to be open to questioning.
And Jack, I have to say, I really appreciate what you had to say. The bar and bat mitzvahs I've attended that I have enjoyed the most is when the young person says, you know, from their Haftorah reading, well, God said this, but I think he's wrong. And here's what I would do instead. And I just, you know, I just smile so broadly at that because I go, yes, you know, here we are. You know, I think the most important thing for any parent, I have two children in their early 30s, the most important thing is to raise independent, caring, empathetic individuals. That's our job as parents. And, you know, and we share that job with our children's teachers and the other important adults in their lives. I think, you know, some of the, when I see the backlash against the teen, at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School, I can't understand it. I can't understand adults who are lashing out in this way, and adults who are suggesting, that the teens are parroting the opinions from their parents or, because anyone who has raised children know that at a certain point, peers become more important than parents. And so, you know, it's important for us to be there, available to them as they're trying out all these new ideas and all these different ways of being, and you know, and to always reassure them, whether as a parent or as a teacher or as a religious leader, that we're here for them, that we're providing that safe space in which they can express themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, since we're going to be talking, or we are talking about what happened in Parkland at the high school, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, let me insert now that I have been, and my congregation has been, tremendously active in the post-shooting time, beginning with a colleague of mine is the rabbi at a congregation, Kol Tikva, down in Parkland, and he had to perform three funerals. And he had to deal, of course, he has to deal with the drama that families are feeling. The entire teen group in his congregation goes to that high school, and they decided to bring a busload of people up to Tallahassee because, you know, we're the state capital, so of course this is where things go on in the legislative session. They decided to bring a busload of people up, mostly teens, but also with some adults, and they called to ask us what, you know, to help them get up here and get settled. So we found, helped them find the right hotel. We then greeted them. They got in late at night, about 11:30 at night. We had a whole group of congregants there to hand out welcome packets and so forth. And I got to start to meet teens who lived through the shooting. And then just the next day was the rally at the Capitol steps. And I was blessed, fortunate enough to be one of the people asked to speak at the rally. And I got, of course, to meet students who were going to stand up and tell their stories. And that was a very inspiring moment to meet them and get a sense of their courage to stand there and talk about what happened to them. And to see their commitment to trying to push forward, not in a nasty way, but in a very committed way to create more safety and a long-term view of registering their peers who were old enough to vote, to get out and vote, to kind of change the culture of what was going on there. Very inspiring. And then last Friday, I chair a group in Tallahassee and that does civic conversations. We had an interfaith conversation last Friday at noon on the two-month anniversary, so to speak, of the shooting at Parkland. And on our panel, and besides the clergy that we had, on our panel was a teacher who survived the shooting. And to listen to him talk about his story and to talk about the students that or his students and how they have organized since the time of the shooting, even more inspiring again to hear their commitment, to hear how they have taken the lessons that teachers in the high school have tried to teach them about how to do conversations, about how to do research, and then how to present themselves. No, they are not the puppets of anyone. They are very independent.
So glad.
And they are very independent, and they are very committed, and they are very smart, and they are doing amazing research and amazing structures to how they are conducting themselves.
And
thank you so much, Jack. You know, I'm also the humanist chaplain at Columbia University and New York University, where we held vigils for Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And at NYU, there were two students from MSD who said something very similar to what you just said, Jack, in terms of the kind of education they had and the namesake of their school, about whom we've learned so much since then. You know, what a wonderful inspiration she is for those students. And at that vigil, I was given the honor of reading the 17 names, the names of 17 people who had been killed. Mm-hmm. But before I did that, I referred to something that one of our members here said. She's a grandmother, and her grandson asked her after the shooting, "So, Grandma, how many school shootings did you have in your school when you were growing up?" And she said, I had none. "Oh, come on, you must be kidding. Not even one?" "No, not even one." And I think for people of the parents and grandparents' generations, this is something. I mean, I grew up with duck and cover, and with a bomb shelter in the high school.
But As did I, by the way.
It seemed remote, didn't it?
Yes.
For these kids, this is an anxiety that they carry with them every day. They have these alarms, these drills, from the time they're in pre-K. And I think that, you know, we as older generations need to really appreciate the kind of anxiety that they live with every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. You know, I remember in high school when I was a sophomore and junior in high school, the moratorium day protesting the Vietnam War was going on, and I remember wearing a black armband mm-hmm. to participate mm-hmm. in that protest to school. Being criticized by some other students and by some teachers, why are you wearing that armband? Because you're protesting the war, et cetera, et cetera. But what I remember is, you know, the passion of being anti-war when I was in high school.
I hate to interrupt you.
Yeah.
But we have to take a brief break.
Okay.
I know. Well, we're going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. Joining me from New York is Dr. Ann Clayson. And here in the studio with me is Rabbi Jack Romberg. Jack, I had to interrupt you. If you want to continue your thought, you
sure.
will. And then what I'd like to get from both of you is just, I know you have had years of experience working with teens. How does ethical behavior evolve from your perspective? And have you seen any change over the years? I'd like to hear from you and Anne both on that.
Should I finish what I started before?
Yes, finish. Okay. I just wanted to let you know where I was coming from.
So in high school, I was protesting the Vietnam War. I remember my passion. But, of course, as Anne said, that was distant. Mm-hmm. That wasn't something right in my backyard, so to speak. And, of course, as time went on, you know, I went off to college and then you get involved in other things. But I think this is very different in talking to these students and talking to the teacher who is one of their teachers. I think there is a commitment to push forward, not in necessarily a loud way, but in a very powerful way. To start to make changes, to get people to vote, to bring issues out in a way that is very different from the way we protested when I was in high school.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm a little older than you, Jack, because I was protesting in college. But, you know, our cliches at the time were question authority and don't trust anyone over 30.
Mm-hmm. Now my children, I remember that.
Both over 30. But what one thing I do feel I have in common with them, I was kind of raised with a John Dewey pedagogy, and that was that civics education was very important when I grew up. And the sort of the decimation of that and the defunding of it in the 70s really, I think, did us great, great harm. And so to see that that you in Florida are doing a great deal bringing back civics education, and that the students at MSD have really benefited from that, is very encouraging. And just before I got on this call, I was on another call with the New York State Civic Preparation Coalition, and what we're doing here is very similar to what you did in Florida, and that is to put into effect, implement the part of our New York State Constitution that says that our students must be learn how to function productively as civic participants. And so what does that mean? So we're hard at work at that here in New York.
Yeah, and I applaud you on that. And Florida has continued the significance and importance of civic education. They've made a lot of inroads in the recent years. But given your interaction with young folks, I'd like to know, have you observed a change in ethics or morals over the years?
I am seeing a very big change over the last year and a half. What really has launched my observation of a kind of a new dedication by the students that I'm teaching at Temple Israel really began with Charlottesville last summer. Understand that I'm teaching Jewish kids who are a big minority, a very, you know, they are surrounded by, you know, by Protestants and so forth who oft times are critical of, oh, you're Jewish, you're going to go to hell and blah, blah. And, you know, so they deal with this kind of stuff all the time. And all of a sudden, it got ramped up to a whole other level. So last August, as we began our school year, of course, it was right after Charlottesville began. And our first set of lessons we planned then right on the spot was to start to teach about how prejudice, that is, that which we feel as Jews, is so similar to the prejudice felt by other groups, by African Americans, by Hispanic, by Muslims, and really did a series of classes on, trying to understand perspectives against different types of prejudices by the students. And boy, were they vocal, and boy, were they open in a way that I had not seen in a number of years.
I'll start first with my family. I was raised Catholic, and my husband was raised Jewish. So humanism was a natural place for us. And our children were raised at the Brooklyn Society for Ethical Culture. And my daughter is now active with the American Humanist Association. In fact, she just wrote an excellent article for the Humanist magazine called More Education, Less Gun Violence. But our children are taught from a very early age to be, or I shouldn't say, they're taught about social justice, but also encouraged to participate in a very active way. So in my case with my children, the best Mother's Day gift I ever got was in 2000 when the whole family went to Washington, D.C. For the Million Mom March against gun violence. We also went when they were young to D.C. for Save Our Children. So I think we're particularly active, not only in terms of community service, but also in terms of social justice. So, not unusual for our children to be volunteering at a homeless shelter or a soup kitchen, and also to take part in marches. So a few years ago, we had a whole contingent that was intergenerational in the People's Climate March and both women's marches. We love marches and demonstrations. We also were really active, in on the March 24th march here in New York City, And what we particularly appreciated here in my congregation was the way in which the young people organized and led that, and then they were the primary speakers, and throughout the whole march were, you know, encouraging people to vote, and that kind of civic engagement. So we've always, one reason I think is because John Dewey is an important philosopher, humanist philosopher in our movement. So so we take his pedagogy very much to heart. So that's always been a part of our education here. In fact, Sunday we had our Spring Festival, which is a celebration of the season, but it's emphasizes the environment because it's so close to Earth Day. So it's like, along with the celebrations and the festivities, it's always, okay, so what's the social justice aspect of this?
Right. Let me interrupt here. Both of you have had a lot of experience working with children, and I guess my question would be, how do you encourage them to question, because that's what it's about, questioning. How do you encourage them to question the assumptions that they may have inherited or may have been conditioned to? How do we encourage them, for the listening audience, to be responsible in doing so?
Well, part one for us, at least in Jewish tradition, is to show them that questioning goes back thousands of years in our tradition, that beginning with Abraham questioning God about killing off the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, and showing them from traditional texts that rabbis have been arguing with God for the last 2,000 years. We don't accept anything as just, okay, this is the way it must be, therefore that's how you do. So it begins with showing them that it's not something we've invented today. This is actually something that's part of our tradition. And then we try to apply it to current things. And we try to put it in the context of having very civic discussions, of respecting what somebody, even with a very opposite point of view, might have to say, to sit and listen and respect what they're saying, and then you can only give a proper response by really hearing what they're saying and understanding what they're saying, and then you can respond. So that's kind of how we start in terms of trying to teach questioning and put it in the right context.
Yeah, I like that a lot, and we do something similar. I think it also starts, we have humanist ceremonies, so we have a baby naming or a baby welcoming. And in that, you know, we really emphasize that as our founder Felix Adler said, that the family is the nest in which the human child grows up, not having shown itself of any material value to anyone, but of having worth. And so we really emphasize that inherent worth and dignity that every person has. And so we, you know, from very early on, we're talking about choosing the ethical choice to attribute worth and dignity to every human being. Another thing I liked from Adler as a parent was when he said, never teach children anything they will need to unlearn. So while we, of course, made sure that they were aware of their grandparents' faith traditions, Catholic and Jewish, and we loved celebrating all the holidays, we also emphasized sort of the narrative of human development, evolution, growth and development. How does one, as an individual, grow into being a moral human being? And how did we, as a human species, develop that sense of morality and of ethics? And, you know, so much of it, of course, we've heard almost every tradition talks about the golden rule. The sort of spin that we put on it is that we want to engage ethically with others. So we say that we choose to act in ways, I mentioned this before, act in ways that bring out the goodness or the uniqueness in the other person. And when we do that, we're engaged ourselves. And to me, that's a very active and dynamic thing. It means that we take responsibility for our interactions with people, for our relationships with them. And I think that really is the foundation of our moral teaching. It's about developing a radical empathy for the other person. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, always listening and reflecting back. When my son was young and he was in the playground, he came home one day and said, you know, Bobby hit me for no good reason. So I said, so if Bobby had a good reason, would that be okay? And then we got into a whole discussion about under what circumstances would it be okay? Would it ever be okay? And so it's a kind of a fun thing on Sundays here that, you know, children bring in their stories from the week. And then we have a lesson, of course, and we have stories and arts and crafts and singing and everything, but a lot of it is them bringing in their stories from their life. And then, so tell me about that interaction. And would you choose to behave differently if it happened to you again? So that kind of conversation that we have about everyday ethical issues.
So, and then to add on to what you're saying, Anne, and to add like another perspective that's not in any way opposite, but sort of just takes what you're saying another step or adds on, you know, adds on to it. One of the things we try to teach as well, which is based on our tradition as well, just as you're basing so much on your tradition, is there is in Judaism a very high respect for individuals and very high respect for each of us as an individual. But our covenant with God is the covenant of Israel. It's a communal covenant. It is not just individual. And so a lot of what we try to teach is balancing in the proper way individual need with communal needs, your individual wants and desires with what are the wants and desires and the needs of the community that you are living in. And how do you balance those out? And how do you make decisions about what is okay for you to do as an individual, but where does your responsibility to the community begin? And that's a very important aspect, I think, of getting our teens, our kids, to engage in society in a right way without over stressing what ego has you pushed to do, and balancing it with community involvement in a certain way.
And as
agree. I think having a community the most. I mean, it's a cliche. You know, it takes a village to raise a child, but it's so important that a child grow up in a community, especially when sometimes we move away from the family we grew up in. And in my case, my parents were in a small village in western New York. Glenn's parents were in Florida. So to be part of a community, intergenerational community, where other people could be their surrogate grandparents, aunts and uncles, siblings, to grow up in that community was so important. And as children, adults now in their 30s, they often look back on that with fondness, that they grew up in a community and still are part of a community.
In the days, and you touched on this, but in the days following the Parkland shooting, you know, there were adults that in the media or in the community at large who really pushed back at the teens who were speaking out. I mean, some of the thoughts shared were along the lines of, you know, what do you know? You know, you were eating Tide Pods, or we're the parents and we are the ones in charge. Why do you think adults resisted these teens' opinions?
Well, I let me interject here, because I have actually very strong feelings about this. And the criticism of the teens, I don't think it was based on parenting. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was based on a particular moral approach. I think the criticism of teens was based strictly on political perspective. And we are living in a time when more than ever before, our basic ethics and morality is being undermined by political perspectives and political ideology. And rather than having the moral perspective of, okay, these teens are passionate. They have lived through something that is so tremendously horrifying.
Right.
And of course, they're going to have responses. Maybe I don't agree with every aspect of their response, but I have to respect their feeling.
Exactly.
And so those who began to criticize, and I'm not going to name specific groups or anything, because that's not our purpose here, but those who began to criticize were doing it from a political perspective and basically dismissing the necessary basic morality that we have to have.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jack. The one thing I thought is, are these adults parents themselves? Because the parents of these students were supporting them wholeheartedly. These were good kids. I mean, these were kids who, in fact, the maturity and the grace with which the students initially spoke and then responded to the critics, they could learn from them. And my first mm-hmm. thought was, how are these adults parents themselves? Because any parent, a good parent, just wouldn't behave that way. You know, shame on them. Shame on them.
And I have to add that in meeting the teacher last week, his name was Ernie Raspirsky. Mm-hmm. He was a European history teacher. He is our European history teacher. And listening to him and asking him about David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez, who were the two teens that are very in front of this, and asking him about, you know, the criticisms of them as being, mm-hmm. well, that they're puppets of the left wing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And his response was, if you knew them, you would know they are such independent thinkers. They are not puppets of anybody. They are operating on their own on their own motivation, mm-hmm. and they are so determined, and nobody is controlling them.
And in both cases, you saw their respective parents loving them, supporting them. There was not, a generational divide in their families. They were very much together on this and in sharing those values.
Yeah, and I have to add this. I think that it was just unconscionable. I don't care mm-hmm. what their motives were. What these young folks experienced are things that you or I have never experienced. Mm-hmm. They had to step over their classmates who had their brains mm-hmm. blown out. I mean, they had to step over blood, you know, to get out of the classroom. Mm-hmm. And how can you – I can't respond to it. It was just very, very insensitive for them to mm-hmm. take that kind of position. You know, they couldn't empathize because they've never been there. We've never been there. Mm-hmm. So how can you really empathize? But I'll ask you, hold your thoughts for a moment. It's about that time. We have to take a break, but we will return momentarily.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me here in the studio again, I welcome Rabbi Jack Romberg. And on the phone, we have Dr. Ann Clayson for the New York Society of Ethical Culture and social media. Are there times, and this is our last segment, and I have 1,000 questions I want to ask you, and I'll just have to have you come back.
Oh, that'll be nice.
Yeah. Are there times when disobedience is of the law is indicated?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah. No question. There are so many issues where, I mean, let's go back into the 1950s and 1960s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the time in which African Americans were fighting for civil rights. Are we supposed to follow a law that is so prejudiced that creates segregation, that creates a lower level of living for a huge chunk of our society? And are we supposed to follow those laws, or are we supposed to object to those laws? Whenever we see laws that are oppressive to a segment of society, we have to stand up and protest. I think we have the moral obligation to stand up and protest.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more, Jack. And one of the programs that the Ethical Culture Society, the New York Society and the American Ethical Union have been involved in since 1946 is the Encampment for Citizenship. And this was a program for young people, originally for college students and then later for high school students, that was started by one of our leaders, Algernon Black, and First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. And their notion was that if we say, after having won World War II, that we've made the world safe for democracy. What does that really mean? Sort of in the same way that we're talking about civic education for the Gen Z, for the children today, back then it was, even if they learn the civics education, how are they living it? So for 6 weeks, there was a lived experience of democracy. And this was at a time when we did not have civil rights. And so we had, in these encampments, we had students, black, white, Christian, Jewish, African-American, and indigenous peoples living together. And the very fact that they were living together, and they worked 20 years here in New York City at the Fieldston campus, and then throughout the country after that, just that very statement of living together put them in danger in many different places. So sometimes you don't have to go out and march. You just have to live with somebody and live with a group of people, to make it a dangerous situation.
Indeed. I will say that my personal family history actually feeds into this. All of my parents were refugees from Germany in the 1930s. Mm. My dad barely escaping with his mom. He was 16 years old, barely escaping just as the war was breaking out in 1939. The man who raised him, his uncle, his mom's brother, Richard Stern, Uncle Richard, was a model protester, because in the first law passed by the Nazis in 1933, which was to boycott all Jewish businesses, Uncle Richard put on the Iron Cross that he was awarded in World War I as a German soldier, stood in the doorway of his store, printed leaflets condemning Hitler, Frick, and Goering, and the rest of the Nazis, and passed them out. And there is a very famous picture in Germany that hangs in the Jewish Museum of Germany and hangs in my office of Uncle Richard wearing his Iron Cross in the doorway of his store with a Nazi soldier standing right next to him. Mm. And that he was so brave to protest, and not just because he was Jewish, but also because he was a member of the Social Democratic Party in Germany, and he saw that the Nazis in 1933 were undermining the democratic values of the Weimar Republic, and he felt that somebody had to stand up for that, and so he did this. Wow. That's the background that I come from. So all my parents, they got here. I mean, they were, of course, separate families. They didn't know each other until the early 1950s. And then after I'm born, my mom and dad, we moved to West Virginia for a while, because my dad moved his business there for a bit. And there we are living in West Virginia. And my parents were forbidden to join a social club, a dinner club, because they were Jewish. Mm-hmm. In America in 1958.
Yep.
It's shocking. Now, what was inspiring is that some of their Christian friends resigned the club because of that. Mm-hmm.
How do we guard against brainwashing?
Well, we have to teach critical thinking.
Yeah.
That's the key. And here is one of my criticisms of public schools these days, is that too much is about memorizing facts and not enough about thinking. And ever since I have begun to teach teens, when I came to Tallahassee in 2001, I have always made a point of my classes that, yes, we study traditional texts, we study biblical texts, we study pieces from the Talmud, but the idea of studying these is not just learning our religious tradition, which is, yes, very important, but it's how to analyze and think critically. How do you question what's in those texts? How do you think about what are the underlying values that are trying to be taught by the rabbinic sages? How do you try and get the underlying lessons that are trying to be taught in biblical verses? The whole point of – one of the whole points of the purpose of when I teach my teen classes is to teach them critical thinking. And I cannot tell you how many times they have recited things to me over the years from history teachers in their high school that I have said, I'm sorry, that is incorrect. Uh-huh. That is factually incorrect, let alone that you're getting into not even critical thinking.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I agree with you. It's so important. I was the clergy leader at the Long Island Ethical Humanist Society for 6 years, and one of the projects that our children had there was to be aware of how they are targeted by commercial enterprises. And so that was part of their, I mean, they did a whole chapter on critical thinking, and that was part of it, to recognize that there are products that are targeted at them as children because they assume certain things about them. And so they put together a whole project. It was up on the bulletin board in the assembly hall. They did a Sunday service about it. So, no, absolutely, that's something that's so important with the way we raise our children, is to take a look at it, especially with social media. Again, the conversation I was on prior to this one with the folks at the Teachers College at Columbia talking about civics education in New York State put a heavy emphasis upon critical thinking with regard to social media. And I'm really quite heartened to see that there are a number of excellent classes in high schools and colleges that that really sort of deconstruct a lot of the messages that we get on social media. And there are good resources, whether it's Snopes.com or, you know, fact-checking, because they are being bombarded with all this data, and so much of it is false. And I don't need to tell you, you know, how much of it is sort of promotes a particular political perspective. And again, not naming names or parties, but, you know, but we want to, certainly our emphasis here is how can we be more inclusive? You know, how can we have radical empathy to listen and to learn?
Exactly. I mean, you took the words out of my mouth, because I was going to ask you that in addition to, you know, looking at the role of school, and I think you kind of alluded to that, Jack. What about the role of the schools? Mm-hmm. What role do they have? And how do we, as parents, citizens, those involved and concerned, you know, alter that role or adapt that role? Because I don't see the role being served, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, hard to answer the question of what should the role of a public school be.
Yeah,
I guess the role of a public school it should be to give everybody a basic education, to allow them to
– An accurate basic education
to allow them to have some level of success in life. Of course, many students go on to college, but there are students that don't. And there has to be paths for them to have trades and pick up skills that will allow them to participate in society in a meaningful and productive way. But the problem becomes when you want the public school to be teaching ethics and morality, because then all of a sudden different groups start to say, but it has to be from this perspective or it has to be from that perspective, meaning that they want a particular religious perspective. And I have been confronting that. And I have – let me qualify this statement in that I have many dear friends and clergy that I respect tremendously in this city, Christian clergy who do amazing jobs. But there are always some who want things to be from a strictly Protestant perspective in a school and will organize things, and all of a sudden the Jewish kids, the Muslim kids feel out of place.
You know, I think one place from what I'm listening where we can all agree on is our public schools need more civics education. So I mentioned John Dewey's name before, and, you know, democracy in education. And, you know, I wish that his pedagogy would come back into favor, and perhaps it will as more states are instituting civics education programs. But in his mind, the education was about providing students with critical thinking and education so that they could participate in a democracy. So getting a job is important. Of course it is. We all need to make a living. But so important in a democracy is that we be able to participate in it. And that means that we need to understand how it works. We need to be able to listen and read critically what people running for office have to say to us. We need to challenge them on that. And when we realize that now that only 17 states require students to take some version of, you know, civics, which is equivalent to a U.S. citizenship test, and only 8 of them require a passing score to graduate, I mean, you begin to see, and I guess there's also only 23% of U.S. eighth graders were at or above proficiency in civics, and their parents, you know, heaven only knows what they learned. So, you know, I think that we can all agree that that the common ground in terms of public schools is the critical thinking required in civics education, mm-hmm. and then, you know, then we can always get, you know, the particular faith aspect to it that you know that our families want us to have. But if we don't all have that in common, how can we be the democracy that we aspire to be? And in fact, you know, we really don't have a functioning democracy at this point.
Well, yeah, we're doomed because critical thinking is – that's the bottom line. It's not taught.
Yeah, absolutely. And mm-hmm. I agree, Anne, with the need for civics education. Mm-hmm. And let me put a qualifier on my criticism of mm-hmm. public mm-hmm. schools. And that is my qualifier is I have mentored in local elementary school, and the teachers are stuck. I admire them tremendously.
Yeah.
The
good
teachers
point.
That I have good met, point. They are so dedicated to those children and trying so hard. I meet teachers who are making $35,000 and $36,000 a year who use their own money to bring uh-huh. in supplies oh. and to bring in snacks for kids who do not have the family money uh-huh. to have snacks right. every day. And right. and they are stuck by a system that is mm-hmm. dictating to them what to teach instead of mm-hmm. giving them the openness to formulate mm-hmm. what the kids actually need. And right. when I have interacted with teachers, with a first grade teacher who knew that what a little boy I was mentoring, what they were trying, what she was being dictated to teach him, he was not developmentally ready to do. Mm-hmm. A sweet little boy who wanted to succeed, and they're expecting him to do things that he developmentally wasn't at that point.
Right. Yeah.
So,
well, I tell you, we have a few minutes left, and I have some key things I want to hear from you on. One is, you know, how do we address this apathy? Because apathy does exist, particularly among teens and young folks. Do you have suggestions or insights as to how we approach that?
Anne, you want to?
Whomever.
Sure, I'll take that on. Yeah.
I'll follow.
You know, I wonder if there's really as much apathy as we hear about it. And I say that because I don't experience it much myself. Some of the members of my congregation who were very active in their youth and, you know, just they keep saying that the kids are apathetic. And I say, well, you know what? Maybe they're not doing things that you see because the kids are on social media or because they're involved in different ways that aren't as obvious to you. And I think that came out after the Parkland shooting is a lot of these kids were very involved in ways that weren't obvious, you know, that they weren't apathetic. And, you know, and I've been reading some articles that I saw in Florida. And apparently, you know, it says that there's the civics education of Florida, the law there has been a big success and that teachers are finding that students are really paying attention and they're really fascinated. So it seems to me like, you know, there is some interest there. But again, as you said, Jack, we need to give teachers the tools and the resources to be able to spark that interest in the kids and to make it come alive for them. When I was a child, you know, we had debates in our classes. You know, we had mock elections and mock trials. I mean, we just did interesting things. We made it come alive. So I think we need to provide, you know, our teachers with that kind of, those kinds of resources. And we see across the country, teachers who were going on strike and saying, you know, we've seen online the condition of their classrooms and their textbooks and how underappreciated they are. So I think we have to absolutely support our teachers in the good mm-hmm. work that they're doing, and help them, give them the resources and the encouragement to make it more interesting and exciting for kids. And on a family level, again, make sure that you're part of a community. Make sure that from a very young age, your children participate participate in community service, that you go to a park cleanup, or in the spring, my son works in the local with the local parks, because as a child we always, you know, went to do a cleanup and planting, worked in the soup kitchen. So make sure from a very, very early age that you're doing that, and that kids can see the result of what they're doing. Adults can sign a petition, they can march, right, whatever, but kids need to see the direct result of what they're doing.
And so, what I try to do, to just add on to what you've said, is to open up conversations and make our teens understand that their voices are important. We care what they think. Mm-hmm. And if we engage them and open up conversations for them, that helps to overcome the sense of, oh, well, nobody's going to listen to me. Nobody cares what I think.
Yeah. We're just about out of time. I know, Anne, that the American Ethical Union offers various programs on a national basis. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us those programs in 30
sure.
seconds?
Okay. Well, thank you so much for asking. Well, I want to make sure that I give you the website address. It's AEU.org. And the American Ethical Union is a national federation of individual ethical congregations. And so we are religious humanists. And we have intergenerational, I should say, programs. Oh, we're also international. We're part of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. We have an assembly coming up in June in Albuquerque, and I'm particularly excited about that because we are partnering with indigenous peoples there. We here in New York have partnered with the American Indian Community House. So Rick Chavala will be one of our keynote speakers, and our emphasis is on environmentalism. And
well,
we can
I have
learn
to
so
interv-
much from the indigenous people.
I have
okay,
to interrupt
sorry.
You all. I want to say thank you to both of you so much. We are out of time for this edition of 411 Teen. To my listening audience, much appreciation for your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Teen archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.